Charles denied responsibility, however, for the popular massacres, and it is fairly clear that between the 24th and the 28th of August, the Crown did issue a series of orders to its lieutenants to contain the violence. But these orders were often contradictory, and therefore played into the hands of Catholic extremists, and who were able to argue that they were acting on the orders from the King. And crucially, like I've said before, the Crown was simply not in control of the passions of the common people. And indeed, the ritualized killings, which involved even mock heresy trials of the dead, incineration of the houses of Parisian Protestants, even baptisms in blood, the horrible instance in which parents would be killed and their children would then be baptized in some sense in their own blood, indicate a kind of desire on the part of Parisians to purify the body politic from a threat to its collective salvation. This kind of brutality is extremely hard to understand in the modern world, and it's certainly not my intention here to dignify it in any way. But I think we do need to keep in mind that in the modern West, at least, religion is a private matter. It's something of public indifference as long as an individual is willing to be loyal to the secular authority, the secular ideology of the modern state. There is no such division in early modern Europe. The religious ideology is what holds people together. And therefore, an attack on the religion is an attack on the body social and the body politic and is treated as such. The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, as it was called, had three main consequences. The first of these, unsurprisingly enough, is a series of mass defections from Calvinism. It would be an understatement to suggest that the massacres of St. Bartholomew's Day were a blow to Huguenot morale. The problem of even making sense of this to the Huguenots is clear from one of Beza's letter to a German friend. Beza writes, "Never has the like of such atrocity been seen. God has let it happen, God who is justly angered, and yet he is our Savior." And here you can see a man who embraces a predestinarian theology, believing that God directs and orders all things, and yet somehow trying to make sense of how God would allow thousands of his children to be slaughtered. A great many Huguenots simply left France altogether. They went to England. They went to Geneva in Switzerland, they went to the Netherlands. Still more worrisome to those who remained behind were mass abjurations, backsliding, if you will, back into Catholicism on such a scale that Beza himself despaired of it. In one part of Normandy, the election of Bayeux, where in the early 1560s something like 40% of the nobility had been Protestant, the proportion fell to perhaps 13% by 1593. The problem, in fact, was not confined to the nobility. It's pretty clear that 1572 was a turning point for Calvinism in France. We know from looking at the surviving registers of Protestant baptisms that the massacre affected Calvinist affiliations really severely almost everywhere in France. And in fact, it's interesting that Catholic churches at the same time begin keeping registers of abjuration, that is to say, registers which record Protestants coming back to the Catholic Church as their loyalties to Protestantism erode. Huguenot consistories themselves become very concerned about this kind of recidivism, and in fact a survey that's been made of 15 consistory courts in the south of France has showed that during the 1590s about 45% of the cases that were even held in these tribunals concerned backsliding back into Catholicism. The second main consequence of St. Bartholomew's Day massacres was a radicalization of Calvinist political theory. Calvin, you'll recall, had equated resistance to even a tyrannical monarch with resistance to God. And when the Huguenots had risen against the crown in the 1560s, they had been very careful to legitimate their actions by arguing that they were defending the crown against the machinations of the evil counselors from the House of Guise. After 1572, however, this fiction could no longer be maintained. It was simply impossible to dodge the fact that the crown was deeply complicit in these massacres. And the shock of 1572 therefore leads to a reconceptualization of Protestant political theory. The key feature of Huguenot political theorization after 1572 is the reconceptualization of resistance. Resistance is no longer seen as a duty, it's seen more as a right. That is to say, the people have a right rather than a duty to resist the monarch. Earlier writings had still clung to the idea that monarchs were instituted by God. Inferior magistrates could resist a tyrant because they too were instituted by God, and they therefore had a duty to protect what God had established. On this theory, however, sovereignty was still in the hands of monarchs and magistrates. The inferior magistrates theory still envisioned a state correcting itself, or at least the machinery of the state correcting itself. After 1572, this changes, and Huguenots begin locating sovereignty explicitly in the hands of the people. The state is no longer seen as being instituted by God for divine ends, but rather by people for human ends. Sovereignty resides with the people. inferior magistrates may resist a tyrant as an expression of the rights of the sovereign people, not only as a duty to an omnipotent God. Writers like Philippe de Mornay, who wrote an influential treatise called the Vindiciae contra Tyrannos, or the Vindication of the Rights of the People Against Tyrants, did retain the idea that there is a contract between the king and God, as most medieval thinkers had argued, but he also adds the idea of a second contract between the king and the people themselves, so that the king is not merely accountable to God, he's accountable to the people themselves, who may correct him if he turns to tyranny.